Australia is one of the most popular destinations for overseas students. And why wouldn't it be? We've got high standards at university, our standard of living, a peaceful part of the world. So how important is the education sector to our economy? And how much has changed with COVID? And are government regulations to curb immigration also going to impact the university sector? And what about the changing attitude towards tertiary education domestically? Are these factors conspiring to make life that much more difficult for university finances? That's this week.
The Morning Call from NAB with Phil Dobby.
The Weekend Edition.
Well, we know that Australia's GDP per capita has been low for a while now, even though inflation is more persistent than we would like it to be. So how much of the top line GDP is driven by immigration? And how much of the inflation that results from services demand is also driven by immigration? And how much of that immigration is the result of overseas students returning to Australia? Plus, of course, the question is, how is the sector faring post-pandemic? So we're going to blend those two topics together, the economy and the education sector. I'm joined by NAB economist Taylor Nugent, who, of course, is a regular on the Morning Call, and Julie Hare, who's education editor at the AFR, Higher Education Journalist of the Year last year at the National Press Club, I'll have you know. So good to have you on, Julie. First of all, just how big is the bounce back in student numbers now arriving in Australia? Are we back to where we were before the pandemic?
It's phenomenal, the bounce back. I was saying to someone last week that a year ago, the sector was predicting that it'd be 2025, 2026 before the sector got back. We're basically back up to 2019 levels. It's been phenomenal. The applications are coming in at a higher rate than ever before. There is just an insatiable demand to study overseas. It's not just in Australia. So I think Canada and the UK and probably the US are finding exactly the same situation, but with, you know, policy tweaks here and there and the shifting kind of landscape around visas, it's just a really kind of crazy scene at the moment.
So is this going to last? Is it just a bit of a bounce back because there's a bit of pent-up demand, or do you feel as though something has shifted?
No, I feel like something shifted. Something really strange has shifted. There, something about COVID just unleashed this desire to study overseas that on a level that we'd never seen before. Slowing it down is going to have to be the government's responsibility because demand is insatiable.
Economically, is that creating problems, Taylor? I mean, I asked the question at the top. How much of the inflation we're seeing is this demand that's being driven by getting so many students from overseas?
Inflation is one lens for it. And I think certainly when we look at the inflation dynamics, you know, just starting on that first, it's not just a demand side picture. Obviously, if we think about population growth more broadly, students in particular, you know, there are labor market implications of this. We're seeing this strong population growth, this rebuild in the number of kind of temporary visa holders more broadly, students especially in the country, has meant that a lot of those kind of acute shortages that we saw through the pandemic in areas of the labor market where students, working holiday makers, temporary visa holders are a large part of the workforce in normal environments, especially places like hospitality, tourism, food preparation, agriculture, these sorts of industries. That has helped ease some of those most acute labor shortages. The rental market is the obvious place where this is, you know, inflationary. And so I think it's fair to say that this is adding inflationary pressure. And I think a lot of that is to do with just how rapidly students have kind of flooded back in after the borders were kind of gradually reopened from November 2021. So there is that kind of supply easing story potentially on the labor market side, but in terms of the contribution to growth, you know, they've been a really important part of recent growth performance over the past year in Australia. A colleague, Brody Viney, and I did some research on this recently, and, you know, the top line conclusion there is that this rapid return of international students was worth a little bit over half of the GDP growth that we saw over 2023. Growth over 2023 was slow, just 1.5%, but, you know, a huge part of that was this rebound in student population and a lot of their spending domestically.
So is that hiding then the underlying health of the economy then? If we've got one sector which is growing so well and that is boosting those top line numbers, are we getting the real picture about how well Australia is doing?
So, you know, we don't think that this changes the broader story that, you know, we saw a very, very comprehensive rebound out of the pandemic. We bounced to a level of activity that was very strong, both on a per capita basis and in an aggregate sense. And what we're seeing at the moment is a slowdown in growth from very strong levels. It is fair to say that rapid population growth, including the growth that's, you know, driven by this rebound in international students, is, you know, potentially masking a little bit the underlying softness that we're seeing on a per capita basis. The other thing that's interesting here is that, you know, student spending, it's considered an export. And so that's probably intuitive for the kind of 40% or so of student spending that goes to tuition fees. You know, that's an education services export. What's maybe a little bit unintuitive is that the spending that students do domestically on, you know, goods and services while they're here in this country, even if it's for a few years while they're studying, is also considered a services export. And so that means that potentially it is masking a little bit of the weakness in consumption so that we're seeing.
So we've got two students sitting in a chicken shop together. One of them is a domestic student, so they get counted as domestic consumption in your figures, and then the other one is an international student, so their chicken is export earnings.
That's right. Yeah. And so, you know, when we think about consumption growth over 2023 was just 0.1%. We've seen very, very slow growth in consumption from those reasonably elevated levels. If we include that spending from international students, it was 1.1%. So, you know, still reasonably soft given the strength of population growth, and consistent with that broader story that we are making progress in getting back into balance. But it does paint a little bit of a different picture. And I think that helps reconcile some of the persistence in inflation pressures we've seen domestically and some of that persistence that we've seen in industries like recreation, personal services, retail, and the NAB business survey, where measures of capacity utilization have been kind of stubbornly elevated, even as we've seen this kind of slowdown in consumption growth in the domestic population.
So, Julie, there's another factor at play here, isn't there, which I think is also an international phenomenon, whereas there's this appetite for studying overseas. There's less of an appetite for studying domestically. So since COVID, I think, you know, in many parts of the world, people are starting to question, is it worth getting a bachelor's degree? And I think the numbers are domestically down on 2019. They've not bounced back to the same extent, have they?
No, it's a strange thing, because all the data would suggest that you're much better off getting a higher education degree than not getting a higher education degree. But certainly we've seen sliding interest in university since pre-COVID, since about 2016. It's been on it's not a spiral, but it's a decline, and we haven't seen any pickup in that. I mean, the most obvious reason is that the economy is very buoyant. There's a lot of jobs out there. People, mature age students, probably aren't going back to university to study because there's plenty of work. And maybe younger people are also just choosing to go into the labour market for a while before they actually head into university, or they're just doing a gap year because, you know, the students who are going into uni now were basically in school when COVID hit, and they're probably a bit traumatised by the whole ordeal.
Yeah. And the debt, carrying the debt obviously is a significant factor as well.
Yeah.
That would make people question them.
So, yeah, I mean, our student debt situation got very kind of messed up under the previous government, who increased tuition fees for arts, humanities, law, economics, and decreased them in other areas like engineering, teaching, nursing, that it deemed was, you know, important for the economy. Of course, it had absolutely zero impact on student demand. Like, students still chose what they wanted to study, but it means that there's been a massive increase in the amounts that students leave university with. So we think the average debt at the moment is around $60,000, and it would have been half of that like a decade ago.
And the government is talking about, you know, lowering the cost of higher education so more Australians from disadvantaged backgrounds can benefit from it.
No, they're not.
So
they're not.
Tell me what's happening.
Okay, so they're not talking about lowering the cost. You know, because of the income contingent loans, they've got no kind of price signals because, you know, repayment is delayed. So, you know, students don't see the cost of education as what it means in terms of studying and how much debt they're going to have. So what the government's doing is saying that it's going to increase the number of places. It's going to double the number of places between now and 2050. And in order to get, because pretty well everyone who's a, you know, a school leaver that has a good school mark can already go to university, in order to fill those places, they're going to have to dig deep into disadvantaged groups, people from low socioeconomic backgrounds, people from rural and regional areas, Indigenous kids, the people who would traditionally not go to university. So that's kind of, that's where they've got to go to find the numbers to build this very ambitious 1.8 million students by 2050.
But is that going to work? I mean, if you increase the supply, but the demand's not there, we're seeing the demand is falling off. What's going to change to make that work?
Very good point, Phil. We don't really know.
I haven't thought through that far just yet.
No, look, yeah, some of us are pretty cynical that it'll ever achieve. It's, you know, it's a kind of a Labor, you know, a Labor Party thing that, you know, we believe in health and education and social welfare and those sorts of things. But, you know, over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of policies and a lot of money, billions of dollars going into trying to encourage those very people to go to university. And there just has not been a shift on the dial. It went up by 1.2% or something like that. So I don't know what they're going to do to encourage those people to go to university, or whether it's actually in those people's best interest to go to university, which is something that we forget. It's very supply side thinking, not demand side thinking.
Right. And yet, you know, we've got this demand coming from overseas. So the natural assumption would be, well, you're going to create a load more places, but they're just going to get filled with overseas students, aren't they? And if you were the chancellor of a university, you'd be saying, well, overseas students pay more. We are, you know, happily fill them with overseas students. Are we going to get the balance shifting here?
Well, there is no cap on the number of international students you can enroll, and never has been. But there's no outward cap on the number of domestic students you can enrol, but there's now caps got replaced in 2017 where they put like a funding cap on universities to kind of limit the number of students they could take. Universities in Australia have always been able to enrol as many international students as they want, so they're not going to swap one out for the other. And then, you know, universities, of course, also have got, you know, the whole social license to operate thing. So if you just fill your university with international students, you're not going to be winning the hearts and minds of the community around you, especially if you're in a city suburbs. I mean, you know, Sydney University and others have very high rates of international students, and I think there's a certain level of anger towards them that they're kind of being promiscuous in and greedy in how much money they bring in from those students. And from the University of Sydney, just off the top of my head, and it's, you know, probably close to, I shouldn't throw a number around. It's a lot of money, put it that way.
Right.
In the billions.
Okay. Well, look, I mean, let me throw some numbers then. So I've got figures here showing that from 2019, overseas students that accounted for 27% of all higher education enrolments in 2019. Now, that is up from 18 or 19% just a few years before that. So even before the pandemic, we're seeing this major shift happening.
Yeah, that's correct. And as we said, the pandemic has just absolutely, post-pandemic has just absolutely triggered this huge demand. A lot of the demand's coming from India. So our group of eight have traditionally had a lot of Chinese students who are, you know, seen as good students by the government because they're wealthy. They come, they study, they go home. Whereas wealthy Indian students have always preferred US Ivy League, the UK, Oxbridge, you know, Russell Group, you know, the high-end Canadian universities. But we've seen this massive influx of Indian students in the last year into both vocational education and into higher education. A lot of the growth is what we call non-genuine students, and that's what the government is trying to clamp down on at the moment and try and restore some sort of integrity to the system.
So this is stuff like you've got to have a certain amount of money for living expenses, you've got to have an airfare back, you can only work 24 hours a week, all that sort of, and you've got to be
24
able to
hours a week,
speak.
And you know, and they've increased the English language credits. That's actually coming on board, I think, this weekend or something like that. Yeah, and they're putting a lot more scrutiny over visa applications. So as I said at the beginning, visa application rejection rates are at the highest on record across all sectors. Some universities are deeply, deeply worried. the vocational sector is deeply worried.
So could the real demand then be actually be a lot less than we've been seeing? Once these are all in place, could we find that actually, you know, we're back where we were, or perhaps even a bit less?
I think all that is going on, but I also think there is an insatiable demand for genuine students to study overseas.
Right, which is great. But Taylor, I mean, what economic problems? If we keep on seeing it rise, I mean, there's obviously, you know, there's the social issues that go with all of this, but the economic impact that we're seeing already, could that just be getting more pronounced if we see this growth continuing?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important to separate the kind of the rebound component of this. We've seen, you know, during that period of closed borders, this kind of stock of students in Australia fell, got down to about 300,000 student visa holders in the country. That's now fully rebuilt back up to a little bit over 600,000. I think when we think about the growth that we've seen since the reopening of the border, you know, that's, there's probably, you know, a frictional pressure in absorbing that influx of population. There's, you know, that those kinds of levels of top line growth are unlikely to sustain, even if we do have this pickup in underlying demand longer term. And so, you know, when we think about this from an export perspective, you know, just to put some context around that, you know, educational aid exports, they're worth about $50 billion a year to the Australian economy annually. That makes it our fourth largest export category. So only behind, you know, the traditional big three of iron, coal, and LNG, iron ore, coal, and LNG. After that, education-related exports is the, you know, the biggest export category. And so, you know, this is, you know, it can be a source of growth for the Australian economy. We've seen how important it's been in the pandemic recovery, the normalization of that export flow. Looking forward, though, I don't think it kind of changes that kind of near-term story that, you know, Julie's talked about, the government kind of trying to clamp down on non-genuine students and see the rate of visa rejections moving higher. If we look at the number of visa grants recently in the most recent data, it's back to around where it was pre-pandemic. And so in terms of actual visa grants, that, you know, does point to some normalization in that inflow. And so, you know, we do think that the contribution of that kind of export growth via international students for the Australian economy will be slowing, regardless of what these kind of longer term underlying trends are when we think about the next couple of years. But we do think that there are some offsets as well. And so, you know, I mentioned before that, you know, one way to think about this is that this rapid return of that kind of export demand as international students have come back has masked a little bit how much of a slowdown we've seen in per capita growth in the Australian economy. And when we look forward, you know, the kind of triple whammy that's kind of hitting household real incomes at the moment and driving a lot of this slowdown in growth, talking there about, you know, higher inflation, the biggest one, higher effective tax rates with bracket creep, and also higher interest rates with the RBA tightening monetary policy. You know, we think the worst is probably behind us on kind of all three of those measures when we look forward. And so we do think that there is scope, even as we see some normalization in that kind of growth in education exports as a driver of demand, a little bit of a rebalancing, a little bit of a return towards some growth in per capita GDP when we look forward. And so we think growth could easily be picking up back over 2% to something like 2.25% when we look over 2025.
And what about the mix of students? So Julie mentioned we're getting a lot from India now. I imagine we're getting less from China because of the situation of the, you know, where the Chinese economy is right now. I know in the tourism sector, the focus is always on getting wealthy visitors. We want people who are going to come here and spend more. I wonder whether, you know, the same focus is given to students because they're here to study. But, you know, if they come along with a bit of spare cash and eat in a few nice restaurants while they're here, that would be pretty good too. So, we know, don't we want wealthy foreign students? And is there much focus on that? And how is that mix changing?
So, Chinese students are back up to where they were pre-pandemic. They drop right off and then they've just come back. They've returned for a very brief moment in time. India was the biggest source country, but it lasted like less than a month and the Chinese are back. As I said before, you know, universities and governments like Chinese students because they tend to be wealthier. They tend to be genuine students. They don't, you know, they might stay for their post-study work rights period, but they are going to go home. Which in itself is kind of a problem because we want to attract the best and brightest to stay here and go on to permanent residency. So there's always this mixed messaging with international students, like we're flagging that we want the best and brightest to stay, but we don't want them all, you know what I mean? And it's kind of walking, sorting out which ones we want to stay and which ones we don't.
Can't we just say, you've got to have a fee. If you get a first class honours, you're in. Anything less, I'm sort of half jesting, but it is a point. If you're here, we want to take the best. Well, let's take the best after they've qualified.
But we've got to compete with, you know, the UK and Canada and the US for the best, don't we? You know, it's the offer. So, you know, Australia has obvious lifestyle things that thrown into the mix, like, you know, and the vast majority, I don't know what percentage it is, probably up around 80% of international students come to Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and mainly Sydney and Melbourne. Like, you know, it's about the beach. Let's just say we've got the beach.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're in your early 20s or late teens, I mean, what more do you need in life? And it's a peaceful part of the world as well, you know, so it definitely got all of that going for
us. Very true.
So is the, what about the mix of subjects then? Because are what students from overseas want to do, is that different from what domestic students want to do? I'm imagining, and look, I've been wrong on so many things in this discussion, I'm imagining that the overseas students are looking for more vocational stuff, whereas domestically, you know, there might be a bit more of a traditional mix, perhaps.
Yeah, well, traditionally, most international students pick vocational subjects such as business, engineering, IT, accounting, those sorts of subjects. And so, you know, you do hear stories of clustering, very heavy clustering of students in certain classes, particularly in postgraduate courses. You know, I've heard anecdotally about, you know, classes, master's classes in accountancy or IT, you know, some of our significant universities, being spoken by the tutor and by the students completely in Mandarin because everyone's Chinese, like there is not a domestic student in sight or anyone from any other cultural background. You know, there's a lot of pressure on universities to diversify the mix of students because obviously, you know, we're a bit hawkish about China these days. And, you know, so universities are definitely trying to diversify, but basically, you know, India and China account for probably, you know, some phenomenal percentage of all international students.
So, and the sector is well financed. I mean, how can it not be if we've got this expectation that it's going to see this massive increase in numbers? And we're seeing it from overseas.
Well, if you ask the sector, they would say that they need more government funding and they put their hand up all the time. So once again, we've got this weird tension between the international student sector and the university sector. So the university sector, because of lack of government funding over, you know, many years and decades, they pioneered and built up this extraordinary export sector. As Taylor said, it's the fourth largest export sector in Australia, which has taken the pressure off governments having to fund them properly. And then universities get smashed for having too many international students, but they need the international students to pay for their research. And they need the research because that's what gives them a position on university rankings. And international students read rankings and go to the universities that are ranked higher. And so it goes around. And then, you know, there's a hiccup somewhere and governments are screaming at universities for being, you know, absolutely, you know, beholden to the international student dollar. And then international students say, well, you know, but we want to come here because you've got high rankings. It is so complicated. But some universities are doing incredibly well. So the five of the group of eight do incredibly well out of international students. And then the picture across the rest of the sector, and we've got about 40 universities in Australia, It's a mixed bag, and some are now in crisis talks, basically, because of the number of visa rejections. The more visa rejections you get, you get hit by a lower rating by the Department of Home Affairs, which means that they take more time to process your visas. It's a bureaucratic nightmare. But to answer your question, some universities are doing very well, thank you very much, but a lot aren't. And the vocational sector is not doing terribly well. And the ELICOS, so the English language sector, is also really struggling because of the number of visa refusals at the moment.
Right. Yeah, as you can imagine. And what about the regional spread? You know, of those big five, how many of them? Yeah. The question is, Julie, I mean, research is all very important, obviously, and that's a determining factor. How many of those top five are near the beach?
All of them. Well, it depends on if you call Melbourne near the beach. Melbourne's near the water, but it's very cold.
Well, that's
and there
true.
Is this kind of Arctic flow from the southern ocean. And I have swum in Port Phillip Bay in October, and it's not
Fleur Peninsula, though. Look, you know, for anyone down there, it's a lovely part of the world. So Taylor, I mean, just fine. So that's great. Thanks, Julie. It's been fascinating listening to you. And Taylor, just final question for you. What would Australia, what would our economy look like if we didn't have this this input of foreign students adding to our aggregate wealth?
Well, I mean, it's a... Surprise me with that one, Phil. That's a very big picture question to finish up on. But, you know, it is an important source of export demand for Australia. It's worth a bit over 2% of GDP. So, you know, that mix would certainly be very different. And, you know, Julie's talked in detail about the contribution that makes as kind of a source of funding to our university sector more broadly, which, you know, the university sector obviously has big spillover benefits in terms of, you know, driving research and other things that can help the economy more broadly. So, you know, education is obviously key to an increasingly productive, you know, high income society like Australia. And so, you know, I think
long may it continue is the answer, isn't it, really? Julie, great to talk to both of you, and a great insight into a very important sector. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you both very much.
Thanks, Phil.
Next week on the Weekend Edition, Bronwyn Curtis is joining me. Now, speaking of education, she did her degree in economics at La Trobe and then did her postgraduate at the London School of Economics. She's received an OBE for her contribution to business economics, and she's had senior roles at Deutsche Bank, HSBC, the World Bank, a wealth of experience. We'll be tapping her for her take on where we are right now. Talk about open questions. That is next week. And of course, I am back on Monday morning for the weekday edition of The Morning Call as well. I'm Phil Dobby for NAB. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend.
The Weekend Edition.